Okay, so let's go back again slightly. You mentioned that you went to sea. What? Why was that, and where did you go? And
well, I'll tell you, I'm full of stories, I know, but I can honestly tell you the influence that Vic Oldham had on me as a person was tremendous. I didn't particularly get on well with my father, and he was perhaps, I don't know, a substitute father figure, I don't know, but somebody I looked up to. He'd been a chief petty officer in the Royal Navy during the war. Told me these magnificent stories. He was a guy that was so rugged looking, but he was very attracted to females. He was full of panache. He was a real man's man. He was, you know, we were working at, I'll tell you a very particular one, and we were working up at Kilmarnock on that Bar Thompson project. And we went to Glasgow for the day, and we went to a pub called the Bottle Boutique. I mean, you imagine what it was like. It was pretty rough. And Vic and I decided to go get to Naval Outfitters and buy some naval civvy clothes. So sort of detached collars and studs back in front and a Crombie jacket and white shirt. So we really looked quite smart, you know. So we went to a pub at night in Kilmarnock, and it was all waitress services. And, you know, it was on a secret mission from the Admiralty. You know. It was full of stories, and he could carry it off, because I was just so. Vic Oldham really influenced me quite a lot. I mean, to be honest with you, quite a lot. And then with Wayne Roberts, when I got back after that particular job working away, I said to Wayne, "I'm going to go to sea. I fancy being a sailor." And I was fascinated by a steel ship being self-sufficient. You know, I think more than anything, it's your mind goes, doesn't it? So I'm thinking about how to make its water. How does it machine? How does a centre lathe work on a ship that's going backwards and forwards or rolling?
Good point.
In a tool digging or whatever. But I was fascinated by it. And now the props work, and now the engine puts the power from that to the props. Mm. So I was very fascinated by that. And Wayne and I went down to Bristol to the Board of Trade to get classified. And cut long story short, I'd already committed myself to go, and Wayne decided it wasn't for him. You know. So at that time, I don't know if you remember a guy called Bert Ravenel, who was the apprentice guy. But his son was called Tony Ravenel, and Tony went to sea with a company called Kayser Irvine. So I went to Bert and I said, "Look, Bert, I've got my classification, you know, for a Board of Trade exam. And I want to go to sea." And he said, "Jim, the best thing you can do is join Kayser Irvine." So I joined Kayser Irvine Shipping Company, and I went to sea. But I didn't go to sea straight away. They sent me to basic training in Southampton. I had 6 weeks basic training. And then during that 6 weeks, that's a part of the 6 week, you would get allocated to a ship. Unfortunately, several of us didn't get a ship because of the. So I went on shoreside repair work when a ship came in, with all the castle guns, all the Union Castle ships come in, the cruisers and that, you know. And I worked on those for about 3 months, and then decided, because I was going home, and people were asking me what's it like being at sea, I said, "Well, we've been to Southampton, I haven't done very much." So I made a fatal mistake. I went to the office and said that I would take anything. So they said, "Right, oh, here's a railway warrant, off you go to South Shields Middle Dock." And it was grim. It was grim. I mean, wow. Talk about education. And I think that the interesting thing is I went as a junior engineer and a fourth. And then it's like starting an apprenticeship all over again.
Yes.
You got to this pinnacle with the fieldings.
Yeah.
Well, you think you got to a pinnacle because we had that point system. Do you remember that?
Yes.
It prepared your pay. And you had a bit of a reputation. And I felt that I got to the pinnacle. Not the pinnacle, but I got quite handy.
Yeah.
And then to go to realisation, to go back down to it like a scumbag, you know, at the bottom. So I made a big mistake and went to this bucket. I only go as a bucket. We booked down about five times before this in the Bay of Biscay, you know. It was a workup. It was changing engine units and block and tackle, it was all handballing stuff, you know.
It was
really, really rough. And so I spent 3 years at sea. I went on to Good Oak Castle and passenger cargo. Didn't like passenger ships because you had to do all the bullshit and you had to wear whites.
Yeah.
So being the engine room, it was like mucky. Then you'd have to go up on the top. And very, very quickly, I'll tell you this first story. Everybody had nicknames. When you went to sea, and your nickname preceded wherever you went. So my nickname was Bones. Largely, in fact, I wasn't very big. And the bones used to, the rib cage used to show through. My nickname was Bones. So the one ship I joined, the chief engineer had a nickname. But it wasn't a particularly good nickname. He was called Sooty.
Oh.
So, yeah, straight in deep there. Straight up. Hey, Jim, if you want to get on with the chief engineer, call him Sooty. So
dear.
I got a drink of the downtime tied alongside. And I was changing one of the units with him on a block and tackle. And the guy called him Sooty. And he went absolutely bananas. I think if I hadn't moved a bit quick, he'd have hit me. I mean, he really would have hit me. That kind of thing. And I later found out that he was on a passenger cargo, a passenger ship, and when the funnel's making black smoke, there's a lot of carbon in it. So there's a jet spray that sprays water to keep the sediment down. But apparently he'd been working on it, he'd knackered him up. And all black smoke came out, and it covered all the passengers on the subway, little blotches of carbon. They called him Sooty. So that was his nickname. And another very true story going on to see, Alistair, there, is that I'd never been used to apartheid. You know, I went to South Africa and I went to Durban, and I'd been used to this black, you know, segregation, awful. And we had these, the engines I worked on was Burmester & Wayne two-stroke engines. So in the scavenge tubes, they get carboned up. They get a lot of crap and muck. And I was on port watches, which was 6 on, 12 off. 12 on, 6 off. So I had a few drinks this particular night, and I was going down at midnight. And on top of the main engines, there was a three stages of the engines. And on the top of the main, I never forget it, there was a thermometer well. And on the work board, my job that evening, that my shift, was to change all the thermometer wells and put new ones in. Well, I must have had this spanner in my hand, which is about, I don't know, inch BSP spanner, you know, it's fitting on. And as I was in my drunken state, the spanner slipped out of my hand. And it went one deck down, and there was a colour boy, and all they had was Hessian sacks. They could hold a sack in the arms, and they were getting some scavengers, and it hit him on the head.
Oof.
And blood was pouring out. And I sobered up very, very quick. I thought, oh, jeez, I've killed this poor bugger.
Mm.
And I went running down the engine room, and they had a guy called the Burra Sab, who was the guy that looked after them and kept them in check. And they'd thought that I'd thrown the spanner at him because he was asleep.
Ooh.
That was the mentality. So it took me quite a bit of use. I don't think I really ever got used to it, to be perfectly honest with you. And then when we sailed up to East Africa, there was no apartheid. There was nothing.
There was no
segregation. But the segregation in South Africa at that time was tremendous. And then to see, you know, I went off subject a little bit, but then to see the Rugby World Cup, and Mandela being the president, to come down to a white captain called Francois Pienaar, and then to say, no, this is for you, my president, you know, the difference between the black and white had gone. Yeah. And quite a disturbing thing, sorry.
No. Okay, so you spent how many years at sea? 3 years at sea. Did you come back onto land, dry land?
Yes, I did.
Yeah,
that? I came back. I came back to decided the sea was enough for me now. I'd had my little glimpse. I had to, settle down a wee bit, and then I was looking around for work, as you do. And I decided I didn't want to go back to field because many years ago, they used to get rid of apprentices after they come out at the time, send them away, and then come back with experience. They thought more of you when you've been away rather than you've been homegrown. There was a little bit of that thing.
I think that was to do with the national service as
well. So I thought, well, what am I going to do? And I met a lovely guy called Godfrey Bodnam. I don't know if you remember him.
Yeah.
One of the nicer, really nice people. And he was at Indelex over in Cheltenham. And I went over there for a job. And so I had the interview. And I said, he said, do you know anybody? And I said, well, I know a chap called Godfrey Bodnam. And this interviewer didn't really take much, didn't think much of it. And when he called Godfrey over, who was in the high position there, he made such a fuss. And he said, the job's yours, but by this time I made my mind up that they can shove it. Because he didn't give me a good, a good feeling about the place. So I was looking for other work, all different other places, and I ended up at a place near Fieldings called Carsby Plastics.
Yeah.
They were in the docks.
Yeah.
So I went in there as a maintenance fitter. And so I worked there for quite a while. And then I got fed up with that. Itchy feet as usual, and I bet steel erecting, and steel erecting was good work, mechanical nuts and bolts stuff. It wasn't really engineering, to be honest. It was podgers in, scaling up, and but I enjoyed it. I worked on Walls's extension, put a lot of steel work up there, and enjoyed getting up there and put the podgers in and that kind of thing. And then I worked for myself for a while, and then it got cold. And it got really cold. And I thought, we were at Pulteney, putting a building up. And we were mixing antifreeze up with the cement. So it wouldn't crack. It was that cold,
Yeah.
And I thought, well, this is it for me. I've had enough. And
yeah.
As I said, I walked in through Fielding's gates in the office side, and I asked if any jobs going. And they went from there, and then I went back.
Yeah.
And I had a return.
So how long did you go back to Fieldings for?
I went back when I was about 25, and then I spent 4 years, I think, 3 or 4 years back with them.
Mm.
And, it had changed tremendously. I mean, the different intakes had come in, but it was still a good place and a good product to work on.
So which department did you go back into?
I went back into Hydraulic 1.
Oh, right.
And then they put me, they asked me to build this device for Chesterfield Tube Company, which I don't know if you remember, that was a press and rollers that we built for making oxygen bottles. Got a square ring of gone through the furnace, induction furnace, went into a drawing press, a punch come down, and then you had to get rid of the ejection come up, and then this thing that I built was like an arm that came out, picked it up, turned it 380 degrees, and then turned it back again, so the mandrel could then be put in to push through the rollers. And it was designed, the draftsman was, but it was designed on the same principle as a jukebox. A jukebox arm that comes out and turns it like that. That was the principle behind it. So I built that one up, and then they asked me to go to Chesterfield Tube to install it and to work there. There was maybe 20 Fieldings people there at the time at Chesterfield. And I worked there until its completion and commissioning stage as well.
Was this the small bottles that were used for the, what do you call them? The soda siphons?
No, these were oxygen bottles for gas cutting.
Very
big ones, the big. And the machines that the Fieldings put in, they made the cylinder and then they concaved the ends.
Yeah.
And then it went on to another machine for necking to put the boss on the end.
Yeah.
And I worked there for quite a while.
Yeah, because there was a project and a press, a bottle press made to make the soda siphons. The
really? I don't remember that.
They were aluminium, I
also remember the fact that we were Beshe Amherst. Do you remember a machine called a Beshe?
Nope.
Beshe Amherst were making clutch plates. And what happened is that when they dropped forge, and we went to a drop forge place with Bob Harding, Bob Harding, and you pull this is like a tripod design, and you pull this lever, and this big great lump of metal would come down and drop onto the die, and the foundations were had to be really really immaculate. So Fieldings got involved with a company that would bring the two tubs together, so the energy level was central. Instead of the force being at the ground, they had two impacts coming together. Do you remember those, Derek?
Yeah.
I think it was the chain smoking guy that was in experimental. His daughter worked there as well. He was like I can't remember his name.
That the press you reminded me of is I worked on with Johnny Mabbutt called the Dynapack, which was a similar machine.
Yeah, or is that the one you're talking about?
We
what's his name? He's chain smoked all the time.
Bert. Yeah.
His daughter worked there as well.
Yeah, Bert Ely.
Bert Ely. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Bert Ely, yeah. But a pipe shop.
Yeah. Well, experimental.
Yeah.
He was in charge of experimental.
And then later on, after that, developed fieldings, were feeling the pinch, and the extrusion presses weren't selling, rolling mills weren't selling, so they had a collusion with clearing, a mechanical clearing press that was, I think it was American, but it came out of Scotswood Road in Newcastle, and they employed a Newcastle engineer called Sagar, who I got on extremely well with, and I built the first triple clearing press, and it was all mechanical. Everything was gears inside, and it was completely 100 ton. The top of it was 100 ton, so we had all the capacity there. So I built it in the new fit shop, and then installed it at Speke in Liverpool, put it up there. And needless to say, I was up there months with remember a guy called Len Bullock.
Yeah.
Well, Len was the inspector, and he had to mic up between the two tubs coming down. What happened? The one section would come down under its elevation, and then you'd have another one come in inside it, and then another one inside it. It was a triple drawing press for car bodies. I worked on that for a long, long time.
And, yeah.
But it was never right. It couldn't get the stick mics. You had to get in between the square. It was a real headache. Because what happened then is because it was like an upside-down car engine. It was gears, and the knuckles went onto the rams, they were fuzzy bronze bearings.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So the only way that you could get it to be accurate was to scrape the bearings.
So
you had to take the half, to go inside, put the props in, take the half cut bearings out. Seriously.
I know, yeah. And then you're bringing back memories, and I'm thinking it's hard work.
Yes, it was. And then you had to scrape them and put it back in and just...
Yeah.
But it wasn't as easy. It took days and days to even think about it. And of course, that reminds me very quickly, is that when we used to get chisels made to make oil grooves in bearings.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
I do, yeah.
They would crank these chisels up to...
Yeah.
Sorry.
No. Funny enough, I was doing that on a fieldings engine at the Waterways Museum a couple of years ago.
Really?
That's another story, yeah.
So I worked on the clearing presses, and then